Hello, everyone, and welcome to Employment Matters, a legal and HR podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm your host, Pete Waltz. In order to fuel economic growth, many Asian companies are looking to expand internationally. Investors looking to do business in Europe are tasked with understanding various rules, regulations, and risks. In today's program, ELA experts from Europe will discuss key employment law issues that managers and investors need to know. Topics to be discussed include an overview of typical employee entitlements, such as minimum wages, maximum working hours, no work on weekends, paid leave, and other things, existence of collective bargaining agreements, unions, and work councils, immigration, GDPR, protection against termination, and TUPE. Today's program is moderated by Jeffrey Wilson, primary ELA member from our China firm, Junhe. As a bonus, we had a chance to survey some of our listening audience in advance to gather some of their questions, and our panel will do their best to address these in their commentary. Let's join Jeffrey as he introduces this program and moderates the discussion.
Thank you. My name is Jeffrey Wilson. I'm a counsel at Junhe in Shanghai, China, and I'll be your host and moderator. For those who are not familiar with the ELA, we're the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers with members in more than 100 countries, all Canadian provinces, and all 50 U.S. states. Our members work together as a team to ensure that multinational companies receive consistent, seamless legal assistance whenever an issue arises. We invite you to register on our website, www.ela.law, to listen to on-demand webinars, register for upcoming events, or to access our exclusive Global Employer Handbook that provides up-to-date labor and employment information from each of our jurisdictions. Now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to our speakers. We have Michael Leffley, partner from Adelshaw Goddard in England and Wales. Philippe Duran, who's with Auguste Dubuzy in France. Dr. Daniel Hun, with Baten Burkhardt in Germany. Asha Gerhardsen, a partner Vinga in Sweden. Danny Vesters, with Bunge in the Netherlands. Christopher Peitsch, with Cerna Hempel in Austria. Now that you know our speakers, let's get started. And first of all, we're going to move to Christopher. Because we're talking about Europe and employment law, I thought first we would ask him to give a brief overview of how the structure in Europe works. You have EU law, and then you have laws in each country. So, Christopher, how does this all work? Do the investors going to Europe, do they look at EU law? Do they look at each country law? Or how does that all work?
Yeah, thank you, Jeffrey. I think when you talk about this question, the most important thing to keep in mind is that 27 European countries are members of the European Union. So basically spoken, all of the big jurisdictions with some exemptions are members of the European Union. The most important non-members are the UK. Michael will talk about the implications on that in a minute. Norway or Switzerland. Doing business in Europe is quite easy if you're a member of the European Union or if the country in which your company operates is a member of the European Union, because there are four basic freedom of movements. It's the freedom of movement of goods, people, services, and capital. And that basically means that, for example, if you're a citizen of the European Union, you will be allowed to engage in an employment relationship in any other member state as well without any need of a permit or something like that. Also, if you're a company registered within the European Union, you will be allowed to sell your goods or to provide services in any other member state without any limitation. When you start your operation in Europe, you will realize two things that might be a little bit surprising. The first one is that despite the membership to the European Union, all of the countries are still responsible for their own national laws and regulations. That's especially true in employment law, so there is no unified European-wide employment law act or code. The second thing is that there are countries with several different legal systems, like, for example, in the UK, where we have the case law system, meaning that the main source of the law is are the court rulings, prior court rulings, that are more or less binding. And then we have a lot of countries with the statute law system in which the laws and regulations are the main source of the law. As already said, the national legislator remains responsible for all the laws and regulations, but the European Union can nevertheless also adopt some legal acts. The two most important ones are the regulations and the directives. directives is that what you will find in employment law. They are not binding and they do not entitle individuals. So if you're, for example, an employee, you cannot directly gain any rights or obligations out of such directive. A directive just sets forth minimum standards or sets forth a specific goal that shall be achieved, and it is up to the national legislator to try to comply with these minimum standards, for example, by adopting a new law in the national in each state or by amending existing laws. Or if the standards are already met, then it's not necessary to change anything. On the other hand, there are regulations. These are binding, and all individuals can have rights or obligations resulting out of these regulations. So basically spoken, when you are doing business in Europe, you will face situations in which there is European-wide law, and you will also face situations, or you will always have national law as well. And the question might be which one of them is decisive and relevant for the given case. And there is a fundamental principle which is called the primacy of European Union law, meaning that national law may never violate European Union law. So, for example, if the Austrian legislator would adopt a new Working Time Act and the employee feels that it violates a directive of the European Union, he must file an action in Austria with the national courts. All of the European countries still have their own court system, so it's not just a European-wide court system. And this employee will then be able to ask the Austrian court to forward this case to the European Court of Justice, which will be responsible for determining whether or not this provision violates European Union laws. In employment law, we have the situation that the European Union may only set forth minimum standards. This is usually done by directives. And there are actually a lot of directives in the meantime that then, as already said, has to be implemented into national law. So I'll just give you an example of what kind of directives there are. I will not go into that in detail now because my colleagues will discuss these topics later on. But for example, we have an EU directive on anti-discrimination, on working times, on parental leave, or on transfer of undertakings, posted workers. So all of this is governed in a way setting forth minimum standards. And the national legislator can do whatever they want unless these minimum standards are met. So basically saying, whenever you will have a problem in the European Union with related to employment law, it will not be possible to just look at the laws of the European Union and find you a solution. You will always have to see what the jurisdiction which you are in or which you choose to be applicable.
So let me make sure I understand. So the EU can passes some minimum standards, then every country has to implement those and can actually set higher standards, correct?
Yes.
So do most of the individual, what you said, 27 member states, do they often adopt higher standards than what the EU says?
Yeah, I would say, especially in Western Europe, it's quite common that the standards are higher. In Eastern Europe, where the jurisdictions are much younger, it's possible that it just complies with the minimum standards, but also there it's not guaranteed.
Okay, so then you have to look at each individual country to see what the requirements are. And we got a question earlier, and they were pointing out, you know, with the COVID situation, you may have an employee who is employed, for example, in Austria, where the employer is, but they may be working at home in Italy. So, or they could be working at home in Eastern Europe. So which law would apply in that type of situation?
Yeah, I mean, basically, there is a regulation issued by the European Union on the applicable laws. And it says the first option usually is that the parties can choose the law. However, that's not that recommended for the reasons that I will just give you, because it also says that if there is no choice of law, the laws of the country in which the employee performs the majority of his tasks or her tasks will be relevant. And it also says that even if another law is chosen, all of the mandatory standards of this country will still have to be applied. So if you, for example, have a situation like you described with Austria and Italy, and the parties agree on the application of Italian law, even though the employee is always in Austria, then all of the mandatory Austrian provisions and all of the better, more favorable Italian provisions would apply, which is not a good idea for an employer. The principles that I just said are not entirely true if the service provision in another country is just of a temporary nature. So, for example, if you know due to COVID you will be in the home office for the next, I don't know, 6 months or whatever, but there is the intention to get back to the original place of work, then it will not necessarily change the applicable law.
Okay, so the same principle would apply, because we had another question. If a foreign investor may not want to establish 27 separate companies or employment entities in Europe, maybe they just have one or two, but they would have employees all across Europe. So the law where the employees are working, my understanding, would apply. Is that correct?
Yes, the entity itself is not relevant normally, only in cases where you cannot define a country in which the majority of tasks is carried out, for example, because the employee is traveling all the time in Europe. Then the laws of the country in which the employer is registered would be relevant. But in all my years of practice, I never had such a situation in which you cannot define a country in which the majority of tasks is provided.
Okay. Well, that's a good background for Europe. And it seems, my understanding is that EU is losing or has already lost one of the major members, in particular, the UK. So, Michael, can you give us an update on what is the current status with Brexit and European employment laws related to the UK, or more accurately, England and the member nations?
So, yes, so the UK is the bad boy or bad girl of Europe, having decided to leave following a referendum in 2016. And the divorce has effectively been finalized. The divorce was finalized last year, but what hasn't been finalized is the ongoing relationship that the UK will have with the EU, and that's still the subject of negotiations as we speak. From both sides, there's a hope that a deal will be done. The EU is by far and away the UK's biggest trading partner. So last year, 47% of the UK's trade was with EU member states. And how things are unfolding, the UK formally left the EU at the end of 2019, so that's when the Union Jack, the UK flag, was run down the flagpole in Brussels and consigned to the dustbin. But actually, for 12 months from the end of 2019 through to the end of 2020, the UK has agreed to abide by EU rules in their entirety, so to act as if we were still a member state, to enable an agreement to be reached setting out the future trading relationship between the UK and the EU. And that transition period ends at the end of next month, so the end of December. And whilst those negotiations have made significant progress, there's still a number of significant outstanding issues. So we're very much coming down to the wire with only a month to go, although the reality is that when it comes to those sort of final difficult issues, I think both sides in a negotiation always wait until the last minute to adopt a final position. So I think both sides are still hopeful that a deal will be done. Things got derailed slightly last week because some of the EU negotiating team contracted COVID, so discussions had to stop abruptly. I've set out on the slide what the main outstanding issues are. So the first one is quite a big issue. So that's the level playing field, so-called level playing field. And that actually is really one of the fundamentals of the EU and EU law. What the EU has tried to create is a level playing field for trade between member states. So essentially, discussions are going on about workers' rights, competition, and environmental policy. So being the three elements of a level playing field that the EU wants to see the UK comply with as part of any trading arrangement. And then the second issue, bizarrely, is fish. And I've never really understood why fish seems to be so significant. It's a very, very small fishing and fisheries is a very, very small part of the UK economy. It's a very small part of most EU economies, but it has historically been a source of tension, and I think it is a source of tension at the moment, particularly between the UK and France. So this is about access to waters around the UK and fishing quotas for those nations, particularly in Northern Europe, who are fishing in the North Sea. So there's a dispute at the moment as to who's going to get the best bit of the fish, basically. So whether Philippe and the French are going to get the nice juicy fillet and the UK will be left with the bones and the head, or whether it's the other way around. So that's the other big issue. And then moving on to EU rules in the UK post-Brexit. So the UK has already enacted legislation which has incorporated the majority of EU laws into national law. So if we're looking at labour and employment rights, it's unlikely that certainly in the short to medium term that the UK will diverge significantly from the main principles of EU law that have been incorporated into UK law, and that, as I said before, is part of the level playing field discussions as well. With its exit from the EU, the UK is now in a position where it's having to negotiate trading arrangements with all jurisdictions across the globe because it no longer benefits from the EU arrangement. So in due course, no doubt, there will be trade discussions that will take place between the UK and China. And China, I mean, China's a huge trading partner for the EU, but also for the UK. So I think the EU is China's biggest trading partner, and the China's the EU's second biggest trading partner globally. And for the UK, 7% of our imports last year came from China. So what happens there will be hugely significant. But that's kind of where we are on the UK at the moment. If a future trading agreement isn't concluded by the end of next month, then the UK will end up trading with the EU on WTO terms, which, put simply, will end up being a bit of a mess, I think, particularly in the short term.
From an employment law perspective, so when the divorce is final at the end of this year, you don't see any major changes in the employment laws in the UK, as most of the, as you said, the EU standards have been adopted and will likely not change going forward. Is that correct?
Correct, in the short to medium term. So there may be some kind of slight tweaking with regulations around working time, for example, which have never been popular in the UK. But for the most part, things will stay as they are.
And if the EU does adopt new rules, directives in the future, will you think the UK will look to those and maybe adopt the same rules, even though they're not obligated to do so?
Potentially, depending on what they are and depending on how they fit in with whatever trading arrangements are ultimately agreed between the two parties.
Okay. And one final question. Christopher at the end is going to talk a little bit about immigration, but in terms of Brexit, so going forward, if you're a foreign investor, a Chinese, you know, an Asian investor going into the UK, you'll need to get work authorization in the UK, which will only be good for the UK. And how will all the immigration change in terms of foreigners coming in? Just very briefly.
So our immigration rules are changing, and new guidance on the rules was published actually last week. So it's all very fresh and people are digesting it, but essentially, obviously what we had before was a sort of two-tier system. So you had the EU and free movement, and then you had restrictions with the rest of the world. That's now moving to a unified system. So for those outside of the EU, the rules will feel more relaxed than they were or than they have been historically. So, I mean, there's various routes to come into the UK. So you can come in as part of an intergroup transfer. So if you're working for a Chinese business in China that has a subsidiary or a group company in the UK, then you can obtain a visa that way. And the rules there have been relaxed in a number of ways. So, for example, English language capability was a key part of being able to obtain visa historically. That's now changed, so there isn't the same requirement for English language before you can obtain a visa through that route. The second main route is through sponsorship by an employer, and again the rules are being eased up a little there. And then finally there's been the investor visa route, but one of the ways in which the sponsorship route is being eased up is actually it's going to be possible for effectively an investor that controls a business to use the sponsorship route rather than the investor route to get in. So that will make it slightly easier as well.
Well, it sounds like the month of December and your holidays may be quite busy wrapping up Brexit. So maybe it's not necessarily a bad thing that everyone maybe is locked down for the holidays so you can get through Brexit. But thank you very much. Now on to Asha, and she's going to talk about employment entitlements. And I think the first question I have, Asha, is employment contracts here are a big deal. Are employees in Europe, generally speaking, entitled to contracts? Or how does that work? What are they entitled to?
Hi, thank you, Jeffrey. Yes, so my name is Åsa Gottansson, and I work at Vinge in Sweden. And yes, the main rule in the European Union and the European countries are that employees are entitled to contracts, or that a contract would be beneficial or recommended, at least. And also, to touch upon sort of the last bullet on my slide, indefinite term contracts would be the norm. So fixed term contracts are possible to enter into, but there are regulations on how to do so, what grounds. In some countries, you need a particular grounds to enter into such contracts. In Sweden, for example, you don't need such grounds. You can enter into a fixed term contract, but you need to make sure that you don't override the time limit, because then it will become an indefinite term contract automatically. And that's the case in many countries in the EU. So going forward with other typical employment entitlements in Europe. So as Christopher said, there are a number of directives entering into in the EU on a number of terms and provisions applicable for employees. And I would say that a very usual question from companies outside Europe is regarding minimum wages. And there are no EU regulations at the moment, but there is actually an ongoing work in the EU regarding minimum wages to sort of even out the differences that are now currently applicable in the EU. But at the moment, as I said, there are no regulations on general minimum wages. And in the countries that currently are using minimum wages, either in their collective bargaining agreement, which Philippe will talk more about, or by statutory law, these minimum wages are different depending on which country you are doing business in. And another area which Michael touched upon is working hours. So working hours is actually quite detailed regulated by the European Union. And I would say probably one of the sort of most also disputed rules and debated rules, but also I would say, at least for in Sweden, perhaps the rules that have had a practical importance for employees in Sweden and workers in particular in Sweden. So we have to touch upon certain detailed rules of that legislation. There are entitlements for weekly rest, daily rests, and the maximum weekly, monthly, and annual working hours, and also how employees are entitled to take a break during the day. And one question that I also know is quite usual is whether you can ask your employees to work on weekends. There are no specific EU regulations regarding weekend work, but there are some countries that have specific legislations that may hinder employees to work on, for example, Sundays. I'm not sure that is particularly usual, but there might be such rules. So you need to make sure that whether that is applicable or not.
So let me ask you a question. I think Christopher mentioned earlier the different conditions. Maybe Eastern Europe has maybe some different standards, but how difficult right now is it across Europe to have some of these same standards and rules, working hour rules, across the entire 27 member nations? And is there difficulty in enforcement? Is enforcement similar across all the countries? I mean, generally speaking. And with the COVID situation, is there any, and maybe the economic downturn, are there any proposals to relax some of these requirements or having some changes? As a general question.
No, I'm not aware of any proposals to sort of ease up the rules. And in terms of how similar they are, I'm afraid I would have to answer that. I think they can actually vary quite a lot. For example, the weekly rest based on the EU directive is 24 hours. So an employee should be off work for at least 24 hours, consecutive hours each week, each seven daily period. In Sweden, that's 36 hours. And in France, for example, that's 35 hours. So there can really be like minor differences in each country. But if someone would sort of not, if you don't have the possibility to make sure what each country applies, then of course applying the minimum standards based on an EU directive would be compliant in all countries as a starting point at least.
I think your slide says there's no requirement for paid sick leave, but I would imagine that the practice in many countries is to provide some. I mean, is there a reference about what an employer would be, practically speaking, be required to provide in Sweden?
Yeah, so in Sweden, we have a rule saying that the employer pays sick leave for 2 weeks. The first 2 weeks in a sick period is paid by the employer at 80% of the salary, and there's no maximum. And thereafter, if the sick leave continues after those 2 weeks, the social security system takes over. But that is also actually very different in the EU countries. So some countries have, as I said, no payment or much less payment. I'm aware of countries applying 50% payment, for example, or you could have a system whereby the employers insures themselves for sick leave or the social security sort of kicks in immediately. So that's very different as well. But and also actually this is something that is sort of outside my scope, but it can be mentioned, it's also very different whether you could actually terminate someone due to sick leave or not. That could also be different in EU countries. So sick leave is nothing that is particularly regulated area compared to parental leave, for example, where there are minimum standards and whereby you could not terminate an employee for using the right to be on parental leave, for example.
Okay. We got one other question before the webinar from an attendee, and they're asking, with so many employees working from home and maybe in the future working from home, will the rules on compensation require, in terms of, you know, maybe covering some of the costs that employees have related to using their home for work, and how would you adjust the hours or monitor the hours from workers who are at home?
Yeah, so that's also something I think vary from country to country, although as we apply these rules in Sweden, I believe is applicable in many European countries, and that is that the employer is responsible for the working environment even if the employee is working from home. So if, for example, the employer doesn't quit the office in the home, the employee would normally be compensated for sort of any necessary expenses related to the work environment. So if someone doesn't have a suitable chair, that could be bought and compensated for example. But before an employee makes any purchases and requests compensation for it, it's of course recommended to ask the employer. And if and how you monitor the employee's working hours is also very different in the EU countries. And actually, it is currently also, I think, very differently applied whether you have regulations saying that you should monitor the normal working hours or just the overtime working hours. And there was an EU court decision regarding this in Spain one or two years ago, which also contributed to a debate in Sweden, at least, regarding whether you must monitor all working hours or not. But coming back to your question, if the employer is obliged to monitor a certain thing, that the employer is liable for making sure that is continued when people work from home. So whether that's sort of logging in and using a sort of clock as we did before, or whether you have like a schedule that the employees fill in themselves, I guess that's up to the employer and depending on which country you work in.
Okay. Well, thank you for the overview of the entitlements. So we will move now from what the employee is entitled to now how to terminate that relationship and those entitlements with Daniel. And Daniel, you're on the line from Germany.
Great.
Yeah, so we heard that the good news about the entitlement from the employee's perspective, and now maybe not the good news, that the rules are on termination. And being a person who's not in Europe, I think maybe one of our perceptions from abroad is that it's very, very hard to terminate employees in Europe. Is that true?
Yeah, as a general notion, you might well say that. However, there is actually no such thing as European termination protection laws in general, right? I experience this often when I come to the US or travel abroad to China, people approach me saying, how is termination protection in Europe? And the honest answer is, there is no such thing as a general law. And the reason is, as my previous presenters here have explained so properly, is that we don't have really, on a European level, laws that apply directly to the member states or countries in Europe when it comes to termination protection. There are some guidelines issued by the European Union, for instance, when it comes, for instance, to terminating pregnant employees, right? That's not a good thing to do in Europe, and therefore it's prohibited in the EU member states. But apart from that, all goes back to national regulation to a huge extent. And that also gives us a very broad picture of regulations. We have countries in Europe where you don't actually really need grounds for termination. You do have to consider notice periods, for instance, right? But that's more or less it. For instance, Switzerland is a country like that, Switzerland not being part of the European Union. From what I know, Belgium is quite similar. And then we have countries like Germany, where you have quite strict termination protection, France, you know, where you also need good grounds for termination and have to pay, and you have to pay anyway, even if you have those grounds in some cases, as I understand French law. But the truth is, Jeffrey, I can't really say a lot of intelligent stuff about the law in Belgium or in France or in Italy. What I can tell you, of course, is a lot about German law, but I can give you a general perspective of how it works on a high level in Europe. What we can definitely say is that there is no employment at will in Europe, right? Employment at will, you might be familiar with the concept that relates to the United States of America. As far as I know, still 80% of all employees in the US are employment at will employees. What does that mean? They can be fired from one day to the other. They don't actually work on an employment contract. There are no notice periods. You don't need grounds for dismissal. And that we can say that's a very, very unfamiliar concept here when it comes to Europe. But apart from that, as I said, there are different aspects and different laws in each country. We typically in Europe distinguish between general termination protection and special termination protection. And then we also sometimes differentiate between individual protection and collective termination protection. What do I mean by that? Well, general termination protection has certain aspects and typically includes, in some states, as I said, notice periods, right? So you can't just fire people on the spot with immediate effect, except for a good cause, right? If there's gross misconduct or so, that's a different story. But apart from that, termination requires always more or less notice periods. And those notice periods are sometimes determined by statute, sometimes by contract, right? Sometimes by collective bargaining agreement in some states. And they can also differ very, very distinguishedly from each other. In Germany, for instance, there is a statute providing employees with statutory minimum notice periods, and the length of the notice periods depends on the length of seniority. If you have been with the company for not a long time, not even 2 years, the notice period, the statutory one, is 4 weeks to the end of a month or the 15th of a month. And if you have been with the company for more than 20 years, the statutory notice period is 7 months to the end of the month, right? But apart from that, as I said, there are also a lot of notice periods that are provided by contracts, for instance. So that's one aspect. Another more important aspect in most jurisdictions, at least in the big ones, is the requirement for reasons or requirement of reasons to justify the termination. That's a concept that is very familiar with very, very many European countries, that you can't just terminate a person at will or arbitrarily, so to say. You need certain grounds, reasons, but this also differs from country to country, right? In some countries, it's necessary to just don't issue an unfair dismissal. In France, they are talking about proper grounds. In Germany, they call it justifying reasons. And of course, there are certain, you know, fine lines between all those terms, but in general, it means the same. You need a reason to terminate the employee's relationship, and typically those reasons go back to conduct, right? Misconduct, for instance, or reasons that relate to the person. If you're capable of doing the work, for instance, that could be, in Germany at least, a reason to terminate an employee. And very often also economic or operational reasons, meaning if you have economic issues, if you don't have the work anymore, you can also lay off people under certain requirements. And as I said, that differs very much from country to country.
Yeah, I have a few questions. I mean, I understand that at-will employment termination is not permitted in Europe, but if you give the required notice, do you need to give any reason, or can you just give notice and then terminate someone? Is that permitted in Europe, generally speaking?
Well, as I said, it depends on the country, but notice, giving notice just means you have to inform the employee a certain time in advance that the employment relationship will be terminated as of a certain date. Giving grounds for the termination or reasons means you either have to tell them the reason already when giving notice, typically not in Germany, for instance, but it's then important that you can actually give those reasons if the termination is being challenged in court. This brings me to remedies, actually, right? There are certain remedies, procedures that are available when it comes to termination protection. One remedy, for instance, in some countries, not in all countries, is reinstatement, right? So you can actually challenge the termination saying there were no grounds for the termination. Please record, reinstate me. Then there are in certain jurisdiction damages, meaning, okay, you issued an unlawful termination. You caused me pain or whatever, and there is some kind of damages, sometimes even punitive damages in some jurisdictions. The employer has to pay then. Severance payments can be a part of the package, so to say. In some jurisdictions, they are determined by law.
Sorry, is severance required in most jurisdictions for a termination?
Again, not really in all jurisdictions. For instance, in Germany, if you only look at the statute and individual termination protection, there is no statutory severance payment required, right? The termination is either unlawful, then the employment relationship continues, or it's lawful, then the employment relation ends. Of course, very, very often, if a termination is challenged, and it's probably 90% of the cases, there is in the end a settlement where the employee accepts the termination and the employer pays a severance, right? But there is no statutory ground for that, at least for the most part. It's different in other jurisdictions. For instance, to what I know, they call it damages. In France, you have to pay certain stuff. In other jurisdictions as well, it can happen that despite the lawfulness of the termination, the employer is required to pay severance payment. And then, Jeffrey, that's a very important thing also in Germany. Sometimes there are some collective agreements that provide for severance payments, regardless of whether the termination is lawful or not. So that's a concept that also differs very much from each country. And then we have the remedy of back pay, which means sometimes if the termination turns out to be unlawful in court after 3 years of litigation, right, the employer has to pay back the salary as if he had employed or she had employed the employee in question for the time between the end of the notice period and the final verdict in court. Those are typical remedies, but again, differs very much from country to country. I think this is a very important message here.
One more question I have is, it's very common in my part of the world out here, you know, even if there are grounds for termination, most employment relationships are terminated by agreement. So while there may be grounds and may be possible to terminate someone, at the end of the day, a settlement agreement is paid. How often is that occur in Europe, generally speaking, that at the end of the day, both sides will sit down and sign an agreement, and then the employee will leave?
That's a great question, Jeffrey. And that's the interesting question here, really. Regardless of the difference in the laws in each jurisdiction, we can see and observe that the outcome is often very, very similar. In 90% of the cases, it is indeed, in the end, a settlement providing for payments or making the employee accept the termination. That's a very, very interesting phenomenon that regardless of the law, that's the case. Let me just mention one thing about special termination protection, just that everybody knows there are certain employees, pregnant people, works council, union members, and so on, they enjoy some special termination protection. There, the threshold for the termination can be higher, and then the difference between individual and collective termination protection, as I said, there are certain requirements in terms of mass redundancies or collective protection that can apply, and this relates from announcement requirements towards the authorities, right, to negotiations with unions or works councils about mitigating remedies like severance payments or whatever. That then apply on top of statutory law. But this is the distinction between individual termination protection and general termination protection. Again, it varies very much from country to country, Jeffrey.
Well, thank you for the brief overview about termination. And now we'll go back to Michael, who will discuss something called toupee. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And I think, Michael, you're going to explain what this is.
Yeah, so well, toupee actually, Jeffrey, that's a wig you put on your head when you've lost your hair, if you've got my kind of haircut, I think. So toupee. So this is the Acquired Rights Directive and Transfer of Undertakings, and we tend to call it toupee, although the particular name of it will vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So the EU origins of the rules of the Acquired Rights Directive, and Chris obviously talked about what a directive was, an EU directive was at the start. But I mean, just to remind you, essentially, it's a direction on the part of the EU for member states to implement certain rules into domestic law. And as Chris said, the directive usually sets a minimum set of rights that need to be incorporated into domestic law. But then it's up to each member state, each jurisdiction, as to how it wants to implement it beyond that. So in some jurisdictions, you will see what's called kind of gold plating of directives. So member states agree a higher set of rights than they're necessarily obligated to by the EU. So 2P comes from an EU directive. And it's really the element of employment or labour law that's most relevant in connection with a transaction, and principally applies in two sort of business scenarios. So the first is the sale or acquisition of business and assets, i.e. when you're buying a business from one company. And the second is in an outsourcing scenario, so what's called a service provision change, and how that actually operates varies from EU jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But that's where, as an organisation, you're outsourcing, for example, non-core services. So it may be outsourcing cleaning services, facilities maintenance, IT, for example, elements of HR, to a third party who's then going to provide those services on your behalf. And it also applies, so it applies firstly where there's an outsourcing from a client to an outsourced service provider. It then also applies where you have a change in service provider, so you fire your facilities management service provider and you appoint another one. There'll potentially be a transfer between the two. And then thirdly, it applies where you decide to insource a service from a third-party service provider. So those are the two main scenarios in which 2P applies. It doesn't usually apply in a share sale scenario. So if you're going to acquire a corporate through a share transaction, then ordinarily these rules wouldn't be relevant, because actually the identity of the legal entity of the employer who's employing the employees won't have changed. It will just be the shareholders that sit behind the corporate entity that have changed. That's one area in which the rules don't apply. But obviously, if you're looking at acquiring a business, whether or not you want to acquire through a share transaction or whether or not you want to acquire through acquiring the business and assets of the corporate will depend on what kind of liabilities sit in that corporate. Because if you acquire the shareholding, then you acquire all you take on board all liabilities of that corporate as well. Whereas if you're acquiring the business and assets, the corporate gets left behind. And essentially what the rules do is protect employees in the scenario of a business and assets acquisition. So rather than those employees being left behind in the company which employs them, these regulations automatically transfer their employment over to the organisation, the purchaser that's acquired the business and assets, and it protects their terms and conditions. So this all sounds weird to business people lawyers who sit outside the EU. So there's a few jurisdictions around the globe that have similar types of rules. So South Africa would be one of those, for example. But if you talk, for example, to lawyers or business people in the US, they usually have a quite pained or confused expression on their faces because it's just not a concept that is really understood, but it is something that's been embraced within the EU member states because of this desire to ensure that labor and employees are protected in this kind of M&A scenario. So the principal impact of the rules is that you have employees shifting from one employer to the purchaser who's bought the business and their terms and conditions being protected, and a prohibition on the new employer making any changes to those terms and conditions if they are in some way connected to the transfer. There's also protection around dismissal as well, so that you can only be dismissed following a 2P transfer in very limited circumstances. But beyond that, there's a couple of things that I flagged on the slide that it's worth highlighting. And I should say as well that this is a topic that has been the subject of a huge amount of case law and a huge number of disputes across EU member states. So it's a really, really complicated, complex subject. So what I'm giving you here is really just very much the surface of what it's about, but actually it's one of those areas that if you're considering acquiring a business in Europe, this needs to be something that you're really thinking about. So one of the other main aspects of the regulations is there's an obligation to consult before a transfer takes place. So that's either consulting with a trade union, if there's a recognised trade union. In certain jurisdictions, it may be an obligation to consult with a works council, if there's a works council. And if neither of those are there, then there's usually an obligation to elect employer representatives who can be consulted with. And then there's an obligation to explain to those representatives or the trade union or the works council what's proposed, what the social and economic impacts are going to be on employees if the transfer that's proposed, et cetera, et cetera. And then I talked about protection from dismissal. There's two principal ways in which there's a financial exposure for the acquiring organisation in a 2P scenario. The first is, and I'll talk now just about the penalties in the UK, but each jurisdiction has its own penalties and the directive requires those penalties to be meaningful. So in the UK, if an organisation fails to consult, then our labour courts can make an award of up to 3 months' pay per employee. So obviously, if you're in a scenario where you're acquiring a business with thousands or tens of thousands of employees, that potentially is a huge number. And then secondly, there's protection against dismissal. So that protection in the UK, compensation is capped at the lower of 1 year's pay or £83,000, which is roughly, I guess, $110,000-$120,000, something like that. So those numbers are pretty significant. So if you are thinking about investing in Europe through acquiring European businesses, then 2P and the Acquired Rights Directive needs to be one of those things in the really top five list of things to consider as part of the transaction.
Let me see if I understand. So, yeah, the rules are very different than what we deal with here in China. So if I'm a foreign investor and I go to Europe, if I buy the shares in a company, I own that company and the employment relationships remain the same and the rights of the employees are unchanged. But if I want to buy the assets of a company, say a building or maybe one of the production lines, then you're saying the rights of the employees still have rights, even though I'm only buying the assets and not the company, correct?
Yes and no. So it would depend on the assets that you acquired. So if you simply acquired a few tangible assets from a business, that of itself is not going to constitute a 2P transfer. It has to be a business that retains some kind of identity. So if you're buying all the assets of a business, you're also buying customer lists, you're buying all the goodwill, et cetera, then that's the kind of scenario in which 2P is going to apply. If you simply went and bought one asset, then it's not going to be relevant. So if you bought an office block, for example, then you may have a couple of employees who are employed who could be caught by regulations. So, for example, reception staff or security or something like that. But that would be the extent of it.
So if a business is carved out in an asset transfer, it wouldn't necessarily have to take all the employees. Some would go across and some would not. And there would be consultations and negotiations as part of that process?
Yeah, and it would depend on, we have this concept of assignment. So it would depend on whether or not the employees were assigned and working with the part of the business that was being acquired.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that overview. Thank you, Michael. We're going to move on to unions, work councils, and dealing with collective issues.
So, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you very much for this quick introduction. Collective bargaining agreements. I'm going to start with this, if you don't mind, Jeffrey.
Sure,
and
go
sorry
ahead.
For some members of the audience who would not already be familiar with what CBAs are. But basically, a CBA is simply a contract, so it's contract law executed between one group of employees, a union usually, or several unions, employer, or a group of employers. And that's what would constitute effectively a collective bargaining agreement. Now, of course, as we saw with many occasions, we've seen with Christopher and his introduction, we've seen that with Michael, with Issa, and that there are many nuances throughout Europe. And the strength, I'm going to come back to that, but the strength, the enforceability of CBAs varies across Europe, of course. What would you find, generally speaking, in a CBA? You would find employment provisions that would usually supplement the law, the local employment law. And CBAs could cover areas like working time issues, dismissal benefits, training rights, etc. So, in fact, at the end of the day, you can have a simple CBA, one group of employees, one union, for example, on one side, and one employer on the other side. That would be what we would call a company-level CBA. But you could also have an industry-level CBA, collective bargaining agreement, that would be executed, for example, between a group of employers represented by a federation or confederation or union of employers. And on the other side, at the industry level, you would find a group of unions executing such CBA, which sometimes would also be signed, executed by subject matters, for example, on working time or on severance benefits or insurance benefits. Having said that, what is also critical, Jeffrey, is what's the legal strength of those documents? Can they really be a source of employment law? The answer is clearly yes, because in many jurisdictions in Europe, they can be binding. So if I'm going to focus on a few examples. If you take, for example, Germany, in many industries, steel industry, hospitals, pharmaceutical industry, car industry, there are binding CBAs. Same thing in France. In France, it's a similar process on the industry level with a government decision that would enforce and make certain industry level CBAs enforceable and automatically applicable to certain industries. That's pretty similar, by the way, with Germany. In Austria as well, those CBAs have a crucial role in the collective employment relationship. In Sweden, the situation is a bit more contrasted. CBAs are not necessarily universally applicable. And I take the opposite example that Michael gave me when we prepared this webinar, Jeffrey. That's the case in the UK, where the CBAs are usually not legally binding. So quite a few nuances. Now, moving to staff representation, Jeffrey, and when we talk about staff representation, we generally talk in Europe about the company staff electing amongst its own members some staff representative who will be talking to the employer, who will be representing the collectivity of the employees, who will be defending the employees' rights vis-a-vis the employer. Most of the time, that would lead to a body that we would call Works Council, Comité d'entreprise, for example, in France, and that Works Council can have very specific rights sometimes. I'll come back to that in 2 seconds. What is interesting is that in certain jurisdictions in Europe, it's for the employees to bring the initiative to have a Works Council, to elect, to set up a Works Council. That would be the case, for example, in Austria or Germany. It's pretty different because it's an employer's duty. It's the employer's liability to set up a Works Council. And thresholds are also quite different, by the way. I was going to forget, Jeffrey, sorry, to talk about Sweden. Sweden is a different situation again. See, Sweden, you would have a Works Council's presence that would be directly linked or subject to the existence of a CBA within the company or not. Now, thresholds, they are pretty variable. Austria and Germany have pretty low thresholds that would require the setting up of a Works Council. 5 employees are required, at least in Austria, usually 5, even 3 sometimes in Germany, while in France it would be about 50 staff, 5-0 would trigger the requirement for the employer, again, to set up a Works Council. Having said that, of course, the power of those Works Council varies from one jurisdiction to the other one. In Germany and France and Austria, I would say they have very strong powers. They are almost inevitable negotiating entities, and you have to talk to them, to negotiate with them. Specifically, when you talk about collective dismissals, they are very hard to avoid in that case.
May I ask a question? So some of the people on the webinar may not be quite familiar with the difference between and the purpose and difference between the unions and the Works Council. Could you just briefly introduce what the difference is?
I was going to come to that. Most of the time, unions are outside the company, and they would often push staff, represent, sponsor employers' staff to convey the union's message, if you will. For example, in the UK, there's a process that exists in other EU countries, which is recognition of unions. But usually the two concepts, Jeffrey, are pretty separate. In other words, you've got the Works Council, which is a body inside the company, and unions would be outside. But in several jurisdictions in the EU, that's not the case in France, you would have some direct external impact from the unions on the company's management. Although very often, most of the time, that's the case in France and Germany, the Works Council is really the key part of employees' representation in companies' management. You should also bear in mind that actually unions' density throughout Europe is very variable. We've got, I just checked statistics for this webinar, you've got a strong density in certain northern countries, like 70-80% of the staff who is a union member in Denmark, Finland, Sweden, while France would be very low, 8%. France is probably the lowest number throughout the EU. The average for all of the European Union, by proportion with the general number of employees in each jurisdiction, of course, is about 23% of staff in the European Union who is unionized. But you can see unions are pretty separate in general, from staff representation inside within each company in Europe.
So if you're a foreign investor going to Europe, you just said the density is different in each country. So let's say that you're a foreign investor going into France and you're going to buy a private company which has a couple hundred employees. Would it be likely or not that the investor would be dealing with the union?
Well, that's a good point, because if you take the example of France, that foreign investor would first of all wonder what's the sort of staff representation that is in place in that company. Your foreign investor, in your example, Jeffrey, would not necessarily wonder about unions. And by the way, it would be you would breach, it would be discriminatory to ask how many people, how much staff in the company is a union member. No, what you would be interested as a foreign investor is there a works council? Most likely, yes, if you have a couple of hundred employees, as you just suggested. And number two, the other questions your foreign investor would like to hear about is what sort of relationship the company's management has with its works council. Is it pretty confident, going on well, constructive, positive, or is it very aggressive, very tense? There are many, maybe three or four hot topics that creates tensions between the works council and the company's management. But again, Jeffrey, as I said before, that is the situation in France. It may vary, of course, from one EU jurisdiction to another one. But again, I think your question is really, really relevant. When you are a foreign investor, one of the things you want to check out before you buy, before you acquire, is to see what sort of collective staff representation there is in the French or EU target you are about to purchase.
So some of these concepts maybe are quite different than would apply in the home country of the investors. What type of mistakes or misunderstandings do you often see the foreign investors coming into France, for example, and dealing with a CBA, a union, or a work council? You know, is it cultural, or what type of difficulties do you see?
I would say that if the investor is not well prepared or well represented by lawyers, I would say the most often trend we would see is not to minimize certain employment law requirements. Minimize, for example, the strength of, and we've been talking about that before, by the way, the strength of certain employment law rules, the fact that certain employment law rules cannot be ignored. And for example, I'm going to focus on Germany and France because France is obviously the best example I know, but I know a bit about Germany as well. When you acquire a business, you've got to go through a consultation procedure with the works council of the target. And this is very difficult to avoid, and you must take that into account. So I think that would be probably the best example to answer your question, Jeffrey.
Okay, my final question before we move on is, when dealing with the works council and maybe with the union, how much of this is consultation, and in other words, just communication with the employees and the representatives versus having to seek the approval or the consent? In other words, management talks to the employees, but at the end of the day, management can make a decision that it feels is necessary.
Well, you really have the right reflex of a foreign investor, because the consultation concept, Jeffrey, is really the one we are very often asked about. In France, consultation means I go and let's say I'm a foreign investor, I want to buy a business in Europe, in France. I go and see the works council, the target, to have their opinion about changing shareholder, for example. Which consultation means only you want to get their opinion. You're not bound. They may say no, they may hate you, or they may love being bought by a Chinese company, whatever. They just give their opinion. And once this is done, you can decide to buy or not to buy, and that's it. But they cannot block the process. And in Germany, for example, I understand that there is a strong concept of co-determination where the works council can sometimes block decisions like for working time purposes, from installing video surveillance or CCTV, if you prefer, and they have a strong power to block things. But you see, consultation sometimes means just getting their opinion, the works council's opinion, and sometimes we also have in France the concept of information. You just inform. But for instance, like acquiring, changing shareholder, being acquired by a foreign investor, or, for example, collective dismissal, you need a consultation under French terminology, i.e. you need to get the works council's opinion.
Okay, now we will move on to Danny, who has been very patiently waiting to give us a overview of the GDPR, the data protection requirements that I'm sure catch many, many foreign investors going into Europe.
Yes, thank you, Jeffrey. So, yeah, let's start at the beginning. The GDPR, the so-called General Data Protection Regulation, and that came into force at the 25th of May 2018, and it builds on the already existing privacy directive we had in Europe as of 1995. And for a long time, privacy was not an issue within the scope of employment, or at least not in the Netherlands and in several European member states. But with the coming of the GDPR, it became much more of a topic. And what does it mean, that GDPR? In a way, it gives you very strict rules on how you process personal data. And processing personal data means, as an employer, being a data controller from the perspective of the GDPR, whatever you do with the data of an employee is considered to be processing. And that employee is considered to be a data subject. And from that perspective, there are certain measures that you need to take into account as an employer. And what does that mean? For example, that means that you have to have proper clarity, being optimal when it comes to transparency in relation to how you process data of employees. That means that there should, for example, be a policy or a regulation or a statement in place. And that explains what you do as an employer in relation to the data of an employee. One of the basic rules that you need to take into account is having that statement, because if you don't have that upfront clarity for employees, in a way that's considered to be a breach of the GDPR from the start. And the question arises then, being an employer, does that only relate to European employers, so therefore employers in the member states of Europe? The question to that is no. Even if you are not located in the EU, it can still be that the GDPR applies to your company, or at least when you have people working in the EU, when there is a connection with the EU, if you do business with the EU, and it's all related to people actually being effectively in Europe, and you process data of those employees or those who are contractually bound in relation to your company, then there can be a straightforward applicability of the GDPR. And that means, as I said, first step, that there should be a proper privacy statement in place. But that's not all, because if you have that statement in place, then that's the beginning of being in line or compliant with the GDPR. Because the next step is that we need to be aware of the fact that if you process data, overall, there should be a justification ground. So therefore, there needs to be a ground on the basis of which you, from an employer's perspective, can justify why you process that data. And that should not be general in nature, because it depends on the circumstances at hand. For example, if you have a sick employee, you process personal data of that employee in relation to that sickness. Is that allowed? Why do you do it? Is it necessary? What is the purpose of that? How are you going to store it? How long? Who has access to that data? And the same goes for every type of, let's say, element in relation to the employment relationship. And that is something that needs to be written down again in that statement. That clarification upfront is necessary. But in addition to that, you also need to be aware of several other requirements. For example, whether or not you are obliged to appoint a data protection officer. As a big company, you most of the times are, but there are also exemptions to the rule. Whether or not there should be a register in which you register properly what's going on with the personal data of your employees within the company, within certain divisions, within certain sections, that also needs to be clarified. What if there is, for example, a data breach? If an employee loses a USB or a file or you're being hacked, is there a data breach register? That also needs to be in place. And in line with that, you also, for example, need to notify data protection authorities, local data protection authorities, or the people involved. You need to notify them. And if you don't do that in time, within 72 hours, as prescribed in the GDPR, it can also lead to several measures to be taken by local data protection authorities. So overall, when it comes to the GDPR being a European regulation, in a way, we need to understand that it is serious. This is a serious set of rules that we need to take into account properly, even from the scope of employment. Because, for example, here in the Netherlands, we see a lot of cases going on in relation to the GDPR. As of May 2018, we had more than 300 court cases about the usage of the GDPR in general. We see a lot of employers struggling with the wording of the GDPR because it's not always clear, it's rather vague, but the consequences can be rather severe. So it is something that we really, really need to be aware of. And when we look at certain more detailed obligations of the GDPR, for example, the data protection officer that needs to be appointed, the question then arises, okay, is it crystal clear that every company needs to do that? No, that's not crystal clear. You can state that huge companies or bigger companies are in general obliged to put someone in place as a data protection officer. But what does that then mean? That means that someone in the company or an external person should be appointed as such. And what does that data protection officer then do? In a way, that's your line of contact with, for example, the local data protection authority, but also your line of contact with your employees and with management or the board when there are, for example, are privacy issues in the company going on. So the rules are rather extensive, but when you look at the actual wording, sometimes a bit vague, but the consequences can be rather severe. And when we talk in terms of consequences, worst case scenario, we talk in terms of fines. And when you talk about the GDPR, most of the times what you see in the news or what you read in the papers are the fines of 20 million or 4% of the global turnover, worst case scenario. We most recently had a case here in the Netherlands where, for example, a company as H&M saw herself confronted with a fine of 35 million because they didn't live up to the obligations of the GDPR. So it is, in a way, legislation, regulation, European regulation that we need to be aware of.
In terms of consequences, you know, you mentioned those large fines. Now, I assume those are administrative fines, correct? From the imposed by the government authorities. But you also mentioned the court cases. Are these being filed by employees?
Yeah. In a way, employees can start court cases about the GDPR or GDPR-related issues. What we, for example, see in the Netherlands is that employees, being the data subjects, have certain rights. And especially in dismissal cases, we see a lot of discussion about GDPR-related elements as well. And why is that? Because from their perspective, by means of the intervention of the court, they're trying to receive an extra amount of severance or a possible penalty by intervention of the court. The thing is that if you, for example, look at that from a Dutch standard, the penalties or the additional amount of severance is not so significant. Up till now, we only see amounts of a couple of 100 euros. However, if a company sees herself confronted with a breach, not only in an individual case, but it's related to more employees, a group of employees, or a significant amount of employees within the company, then you might get a situation where not only one, but the majority or a huge amount of employees go to court and say, it's not only this specific individual, but it relates to all of us. And then you get a class action in relation to which the penalties could be much, much more severe. And don't forget, in relation to all this, it's not only the severance or the amount of money that needs to be paid by the company, but it can also be commercial damage as well. Because everything, for example, here in the Netherlands, that's going on with the GDPR, we read that in the newspaper. We see that at the news in the evening, meaning that the company is then in the news in relation to which they state the GDPR has not been lived up to properly, which is not good for the position of your business overall. So yeah, it can lead to individual, but also mass consequences as well from an employee's perspective. Yeah, it's a new element in the game. Let's put it like that.
So you mentioned that, you know, the employer has to come out with some rules and it has to have justification for collecting the data.
Yeah.
Is consent also required, or is consent relevant?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a lot of discussion going on about consent, because consent on the basis of Article 6 of the GDPR is considered to be one of the justification grounds on the basis of which you can justify, from an employer's perspective, why you process data. But it's not the only ground. Within the scope of employment, you also see that employers use, for example, legitimate interests as one of the justification grounds, but also that they need data because of the performance of the employment agreement. So there are alternatives besides consent. And consent is rather challenging because, first of all, consent can be withdrawn on every time. So if you try to justify whatever you do with the data of an employee on the basis of consent, that consent can be given on a Monday, and on a Tuesday it can be withdrawn by the employee, meaning that there is no justification ground. So that's tricky. That's the first thing. The second thing is, within the scope of employment, there is a hierarchical relationship between the employer and the employee. And in relation to consent, it is of importance that consent needs to be given freely. So it needs to be the employee should be able to freely give his or her consent about why data is being processed and if data is being processed. And from a European perspective, we also have an authority looking at all that's going on with the GDPR from a European perspective, the so-called European Data Protection Board. It already has been stated that in the relationship between an employee and an employer, consent cannot be freely given. So in general, that would mean that it cannot be seen or qualified as a justification ground. However, among Europe, we see consent very, very often in, for example, statements and regulations as being the first step towards an overall justification. My advice is don't only bet on consent, because it's tricky, it's challenging. So if you have a statement or a regulation or a policy in place, also write towards that you need the information necessary for the performance of the employment contract, or, for example, that you have a legitimate interest as well. Don't bet all the money on one horse. Try to use everything or every element that you have to justify what you do when it comes to processing data of your employees.
Okay, my final question is for example, in China, we struggle with the difference between what is called sensitive data and then maybe general employee data. Is there a difference in the law in Europe? And maybe you can give a few examples of how the different types of information is treated.
Yeah. When it comes to personal data, you need to distinguish general data on the one hand, and you have sensitive categories of personal data. General data, in a way, is data that's related to the individual, the data subject. It can be everything. However, Article 9 of the GDPR specifically states that sensitive data is classified and is described by the regulation itself. It can be health. It can be your political beliefs. It can be your sexual orientation. Those types of information are considered to be sensitive data. And what we very, very often see in the scope of employment is sensitive data related to health, for example, when it comes to sick employees. And why is that challenging? Because everything when it comes to health qualifying as sensitive data, you are prohibited, that's the main rule, to process that type of data as being an employer. Before you are actually able to move forward with processing that data, you need to look at the system of the GDPR, meaning that you need to make use of one of the exemptions as prescribed in the GDPR or in local legislation, which can differ for each member state. So the distinguishment between general data and sensitive data is of relevance, because general data you can process if it is justified, the justification grounds of Article 6, but if it's sensitive data, the main rule is you're not allowed to do so. First of all, you need to move forward with an exemption, and if you have that exemption, then the question is, in general, is it justified, for which you again go forward with the justification grounds of Article 6. So systematically, you need to take an extra step when it comes to sensitive data.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Danny, for that concise overview of the GDPR. Finally, we'll go back to Christopher for a few words on immigration and how it relates to employees from abroad coming in to the EU, and whether it's one country approval and whether employees can move around who are foreigners.
Yes, thank you, Jeffrey. When it comes to immigration, I think everything we said about employment law is even more true. There is no unified code in Europe, and all the countries have their own system. So it's even less possible to give you an idea or a 100% true guarantee that if you comply with this or that provision, you will be fine. Basically saying wherever the employee shall go, you will need a case-by-case assessment of what the laws of the country require. When it comes to immigration, I see three different scenarios. And what I will try to do today is just to give you a feeling of what might be an issue and what might be fine anyway. I think one of the scenarios are short business trips. So an employee comes to Europe for a couple of days to participate in a meeting or in a fair or something like this without providing any additional services. Something like that is usually fine, meaning that no permits are needed, meaning that no notification obligations exist. Of course, the employee will require a visa to enter the country, but that's basically it. Again, saying please check with the laws of the country in which the employees will go to see whether there's any deviation from that. Then the second aspects are postings to Europe, like personal lease or secondment. Not all of the countries are distinguishing between those two things. Basically, a personal lease means that the employee is provided. For example, if you have an employee with the office in Shanghai and you send him to the Austrian office and he will be integrated in this office and work here like an Austrian employee, that would be a personal lease. On the other hand, a secondment would be the case if the employee just provides services that that his foreign employer owes to a client in Europe, and he uses this employee to provide these services. In such cases, there are usually some notification obligations. It's usually necessary to keep some documents at the place of work, like, for example, an employment contract and something familiar like wage slips or working time records. And it's also usually necessary to have a work or secondment permit, depending on what exactly is going on in Europe. Then the third scenario would be a permanent employment relationship in Austria with a, in Europe with a permanent place of work in one of the European countries. And that will always require a work permit unless the employee is a citizen of the European Union. There are many different kind of permits, so I can't even tell you go for that permit or for that. For example, in Austria, we have like 10 or 15 different work permits. Usually, for example, it's necessary to have some kind of training. It's better to be a younger employee. It's also an issue how much remuneration you will receive. And depending on that, you will collect some points. And depending on the amount of points, you will then be qualified to, for example, a work permit for high potentials or for just key employees or for anything else.
Maybe if I could finish up by asking a couple of very, very brief questions. Now, I understand the freedom of movement within the EU applies to citizens of EU countries, but for immigration purposes, is it country by country? In other words, if someone from China goes to Austria, they get the work authorization in Austria and they can only work there. They can't get up and move and work in France, correct?
Basically, yes. There is a blue card EU. That's the only EU-wide work permit, but it's not that appreciated by the countries. And there are even, let's say, countries trying to get rid of this system. So far, there is no final decision on that. But this blue card basically entitles you to work and live in the European Union. But even, for example, if you have a blue card from Finland and want to go to Austria, it's not a 100% guarantee that you don't need anything in addition to that. So this, there is a unified work permit, but it's not a guarantee that you just need this. Also, especially in the first 2 years, it's bound to a specific job. So when you apply for the blue card, you will have to provide an employment contract or a job offer that must meet specific requirements, like a minimum salary and so on. And based on the job offer that was provided, the blue card will be issued. So for the first 2 years, you can't just change your job or go to another employer. Any change must be approved by authorities. So yeah, the answer is it's really a case-by-case and country-by-country thing.
Okay. And my final question is it possible, for example, if you have an employee coming here from Shanghai who's employed by a Shanghai company and doesn't want to terminate that employment relationship, can they get authority to work in Europe as in a secondee? Is that possible?
Basically, it is possible to second employees to Europe. You don't need an entity here. But of course, the question is which kind of labor law applies in such a case. And even though you might remain under, for example, the Chinese labor law system, you will have to comply with all the minimum standards regarding remuneration, vacation, or working time that are applicable in the country to which the employee is seconded. So that must also be respected with regard to immigration.
Okay. Well, that's clear. So thank you for that brief review of the immigration requirements. And thank you to all of our presenters, to Christopher and all the other speakers today. We've used up all of our time, so unfortunately, we don't have time for questions. I see that we did get a few questions that we have not answered by email, so I'll ask the speakers to reply directly, if possible, to those of you who sent in questions.
Thanks, Jeffrey, and also to our panel for sharing your thoughts and advice on today's topic. If you'd like to connect with any of our lawyers on the program, please search for them on the ELA website at ela.law. There you can sign up to receive invitations for upcoming webinars, download white papers, get access to on-demand content, or use the ELA's exclusive Global Employer Handbook. You've been listening to Employment Matters, a podcast brought to you by the Employment Law Alliance, the world's largest network of labor and employment lawyers from the best law firms around the globe. I'm Pete Waltz. Thanks for listening.